Shinrin Yoku is the Japanese practice of forest bathing, which is growing in popularity around the world for its therapeutic benefits, both physiological and psychological. Forest bathing engages the parasympathetic nervous system, known as the rest and digest system. It's the opposite to our fight or flight sympathetic nervous system. Also called forest therapy, it's been shown to lower blood pressure, pulse rate, and levels of the stress hormone cortisol, as well as having mental health benefits. Jeffrey Hansfield is a certified forest guide, teaching others how to make the most of their time in the forest. But he's also a senior research fellow with the Auckland Bioengineering Institute at the University of Auckland. His work is with the Musculoskeletal Modelling Group, researching cerebral palsy and its effect on the muscles. We began by discussing what forest bathing is.
Well, forest bathing is it's basically a system or a program around going on guided immersive walks in the forest. And so anyone could take a walk through the forest anytime they like, but the specifically the forest bathing walks are geared towards slowing down, engaging the parasympathetic nervous system, getting away from the, some people call it the monkey mind. So it's the sort of the intrusive thoughts that keep sort of popping up. So forest bathing is this formalized practice that is immersing in nature, slowing oneself down, and sort of being present in that space.
Where do you do your forest bathing?
So I guide walks around Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. So I'll sometimes guide walks in the Domain, or I've guided walks in Cornwall Park, the Botanic Gardens. So basically anywhere that we have forests that we can go and spend time in and be among the trees. And I'm open to walks in other places as well, but I'm based in Tamaki Makaurau.
What first got you into forest bathing?
Well, I was working in my science job. I was I'm a bioengineer, and I was working in Amsterdam during COVID, during one of the lockdowns, and I was there to do some work with a group at a university. But things were pretty slow because of COVID and because of the curfews and lockdowns. And so I basically was in an apartment in Amsterdam in winter, and it was lockdown and it was COVID, and I was feeling a bit blue about it all. And so I found myself sort of web surfing nature things that I'd be able to do when the lockdown ended. And on meetup.com, I found a guided forest bathing walk that was being led by a certified forest therapy guide, forest bathing guide. And when I saw that, I sort of had to learn more. I didn't know that you could certify in this. And so I sort of did a bit more digging and followed a few more links and discovered this organization, the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy Guides, and saw that they were starting a training cohort soon. And so sent some emails, and I eventually had a Zoom meeting with a woman on Aotea, Great Barrier Island, named Vicky Kyan. And Vicks and I had a really wonderful conversation about what forest bathing and forest therapy was, and what's the point of a guide, and how it all works. And so after that conversation, I decided it was all too serendipitous to not sign up and engage with the training. So it ended up being a bit of a lockdown project for me.
Can you explain the answer to some of those things? The purpose of having a guide, is there a certain amount of time that this involves to really work, a certain pace? Is there a level of meditation that makes it work?
Definitely. Yeah. Well, I guess I'd start by saying that, I think anyone who wants to spend time in nature, that's always a good, that's always a good thing. And so if people want to just take themselves on a walk or go for a trail run or anything like that, those are all really great. Forest bathing is a bit different though. And so the purpose of a guide is basically to lead people through a progression of what we call invitations. And that invitation is basically it's an invitation to people to interact with the forest in a specific way. And each of those invitations is crafted to spend time with nature, so nature immersion. But there's some sort of psychological and physiological intentions behind each of those invitations. So slowing people down, engaging that parasympathetic nervous system, that's the rest and digest part of your nervous system. And so there is a meditative component to forest bathing, and the purpose of a guide is to open those doors and to promote people slowing down, engaging with nature in this kind of way. I use the analogy of a yoga instructor. So people can do yoga on their own any place they like, but often people like to go with an instructor who has a set of, progressive poses with an intention behind it. And so that's what you would get from a forest therapy guide.
So what are some of those invitations? Some people may straight away think of tree hugging, right? But what are some of the other invitations, some of the other interactions that can happen? I think of something like the pleasure of moss under my feet, say. But what sorts of things?
Well, there are many. There are many. And there is a structure that as guides we're trained to basically create invitations according to certain guidelines and structures. And so there are many guides around the world who have created invitations and shared them with other guides. And some guides, have their own sets of invitations that they've created. Often the invitations are based around the particular space that someone's guiding in. So some guides will actually guide in kind of maritime forests near the ocean, and so they'll have invitations that take advantage of that, those aspects of nature. But just as an example, so there are invitations around taking your shoes off if you feel comfortable doing that, and walking and feeling the ground under your feet, as you kind of alluded to. There are invitations that are around opening up your sense of hearing and engaging your sense of hearing and paying attention to the way that the sounds in the forest change. There are invitations geared around slowing yourself down and moving quite slowly, slowly than you might otherwise through the forest. And so each of these is designed on opening up a different sense, and engaging. It could be in some cases your imagination, or engaging a sense of play, or just engaging being present and being sensory aware. So.
There's been really interesting research done on Shinrin-ryoku, which is the Japanese practice of forest bathing, and quite remarkable results when it comes to a very important measure for all of our health, which is lowering blood pressure. And that effect can be pretty immediate. What else have you learned about the science behind this, what it does, and why?
Yeah, well, there's a field of study that is called forest medicine, and it sort of launched around the same time that forest bathing was becoming a sort of a formalized health practice in Japan. And so researchers were basically studying the question of what happens to the body, what are the health benefits of being immersed in a forest environment. And so, there are scientists they're still practicing them this today, and their research has blossomed in other parts of the world as well, in Switzerland and in Norway, and I think there's some groups in Canada. But essentially, so some of the big results, as you mentioned, is lowering of blood pressure, lowering of pulse rate. Cortisol is a circulating stress chemical, and so they've measured cortisol in the blood and found that cortisol declines when people spend time slowing down in a nature environment. One of the really fascinating ones are natural killer cells, or NK cells. And so there's been a lot of research on how natural killer cells, part of your body's immune system, will increase. So you have a boost in NK cells when you spend time forest bathing. And the purpose of those natural killer cells is to find abnormally replicating cells in your body and to kill those cells. And so those abnormally replicating cells are essentially cancerous or precancerous cells. And so there are some cancer-fighting benefits to nature immersion and forest bathing.
We talk a lot about the blue effect and the green effect, which is a mental health effect. Those who live near the water or see blue water a lot have a measurably observable gain in mental health, and ditto for green, slightly less for green from memory, but a green effect if you live near a green belt in your city. But what else is it about forests? So that's one presumes that's a psychological and a mental health reaction. What is it about forests that adds particular benefit? And is some of this to do with the actual chemicals that plants release?
Definitely, yeah. So I'll start by talking about the physiological effects. I mentioned NK cells, natural killer cells. And some of the research in the field of forest therapy has linked this rise in natural killer cells to there's a class of chemicals that plants and trees release called they're called phytoncides. And phytoncides is part of a plant's immune system. There are these chemicals that the plant emits externally when it encounters some kind of immune threat. So it could be a virus or bacteria or fungus, and the tree or plant will sort of shower itself with these chemicals, these phytoncides. And it turns out when we are exposed to phytoncides, that class of chemicals, when we breathe those, it actually boosts our immune system and boosts our natural killer cells. There very well may be other particular benefits that happen when we're exposed to those chemicals. But you know, for now, there's quite a lot of research on natural killer cells and our immune system in particular. So yeah, those phytoncides, exposure to that is actually quite good for us, for our immune system. And when we go forest bathing, we're literally, you know, showering ourselves in phytoncides that are being emitted by trees and plants all around us.
Who is doing this research? Again, I think there's a couple of key figures in Japan who are doing, quite deliberate research. One of them, I think, is one of the directors of the Forest Therapy Society, yeah?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the two names that I know quite well from forest medicine in Japan are Yoshifumi Miyazaki. So he's at Chiba University in the medical school, and then Cheng Li is the other. They've both written books actually on forest therapy on Shin-Ryoku, and they've done quite a lot of primary research into these questions. There are other people as well who have kind of dove into this field of study, and it's actually quite a growing area. So, for people who are really interested in the primary research, if you look into nature therapy or Shin-Ryoku or forest bathing research on, say, Google Scholar, you'll find many, many dozens of primary research articles in this area.
So you've led guided tours, you've become a certified guide in forest therapy. Can you give us some more insights into how to do this well? Can it happen walking? Do you need to walk and then stop and, as we said, accept these invitations or meditate? What is it that makes it different from just a walk in the forest or a walk in the park?
Well, I think the big thing is the slowing down and the progression of invitations that a certified guide will take people through. As I said before, I encourage people to spend as much time in nature as they want or can. And I think any activity spent in nature and forest environments is good for people. But I think the difference is, like I came from an outdoor kind of sports background. I love trail running and mountain biking and I go rock climbing with friends. But often when I'm doing those activities, I'm sort of mission oriented, and you're trying to run through the forest or bike through the forest, you're getting somewhere. And that's all well and good, but I think you miss some of this this slowing down, this unplugging and really purposefully disconnecting and being present. And again, there's just some tremendous psychological benefits that come when you do that. And I think some people may appreciate that it's not easy to, if someone tells you just to go and be present or go and unplug or go and disconnect, hearing that and putting into practice, I think are two very different things. And I think that's where the forest therapy helps people. It's a specific progression that we take people through to enable that so that people have that becoming present, disconnecting the some people call it the monkey mind, very, very deliberately and intentionally slowing down. So that's what I think is the benefit of guided forest bathing, guided forest therapy.
It's harder and harder to find these spaces, though, is it? Even in our urban centres, and there's a clash of interests: the mountain biking through the bush and through urban forests or urban parks is a wonderful health initiative, and but is it hard for you to be doing your meditating when a bike is roaring next door? Is it harder and harder to find a space where one can truly become immersed away from the sounds and activities of our busy lives?
I think yes and no. I think we're really fortunate to live in New Zealand where we do have we have a lot of bush and we have a lot of remote bush that people can go to. It's, I think there's always that fight to be had to preserve native bush and to regrow native forests where we've lost some. But we do have some great opportunities here in New Zealand. With that said, the other way that I look at what I do is I want to take people who are living, busy lives and are stressed and have a lot going on and give them, 2 or 3 hours of reprieve from that. And so I guide in, city parks, the Domain and Cornwall Park. The reality is where we are is it's a city park. It's an urban park, and we're really fortunate to have it. In general, the way we structure it, hearing city noises doesn't take away from what we're there to do.
Geoffrey Hansfield is our guest. We're talking about forest bathing, and he is now a certified forest guide, teaching others how to make the most of their time in the forest. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Geoffrey is also a senior research fellow with the Auckland Bioengineering Institute at the University of Auckland, and his work is with the Musculoskeletal Modelling Group, researching cerebral palsy and its effect on the muscles. Can you tell us more about what you're specifically looking into and working on, Geoffrey?
So I'm as you mentioned, I'm a senior research fellow in bioengineering. And where I work in the Auckland Bioengineering Institute, we have a lot of specialization in computational modeling. So basically taking laws of physics and physiology, our understanding of how biological and physiological systems work, and constructing computer models with that information to basically understand the mechanics or the dynamics of these systems. And so what I've been looking at recently is trying to understand the progression of cerebral palsy in the muscles. So we frequently see as kids, young people with cerebral palsy, as they age, we see a loss of muscle function, a loss of muscle strength, and what might be called degeneration, although we're still kind of untangling whether it's degeneration or whether it's a lack of growth in those muscles as the body is growing around it. So we're using a combination of imaging, advanced medical imaging, and then computer models that we build to try to understand that process of what's happening as kids are growing and aging with cerebral palsy and how that's affecting the muscles.
And what are the possible implications of learning more? What could it mean?
Well, there's a few potential sort of pharmaceutical interventions that are, it's a little bit outside of what I specifically do. But the idea is that if we can understand the dynamics of the muscles in kids with cerebral palsy, it might point us to some interventions that we could have. Whether those are pharmaceutical interventions, could potentially be physiotherapy interventions. There are a few different sort of mechanical treatments that are available, like vibration therapy, different ways of tailoring physiotherapy for kids with cerebral palsy. So basically, just understanding more about what's happening as when kids are young, what's happening to their muscles, I think is going to point us to a few different options for treating and mitigating that condition.
Have you found some events or growth at cellular level of muscles in CP actually contributing to what you describe as muscle degeneration? What's some of the stuff you have learned?
Yeah, one of the big, I guess, the big culprits of this degeneration is a cell called satellite cells. So satellite cells are they're the stem cell in skeletal muscle. So skeletal muscle is quite what we call plastic, which means that it responds to stimulus. So if you're sedentary for a long time, your skeletal muscles tend to shrink. They get smaller and weaker. If you work out, they get bigger and stronger. And skeletal muscles are constantly responding, by growing and shrinking and elongating in response to the demands we place on it. And the cell that's responsible for that is called a satellite cell. And these cells basically live right under the cell membrane of the skeletal muscle. And different cues, different signals and factors will mobilize those satellite cells to leave a state of quiescence, is called, and they'll basically contribute to repairing or fusing to form new skeletal muscle tissue. And it turns out that kids with cerebral palsy, for reasons that we're still trying to understand, it appears that they have fewer satellite cells available for repairing damage to their muscles. So we don't again, we don't know exactly why that is, but in our models, when we build models that have fewer satellite cells, we find some really interesting dynamics between satellite cells and some of the other cells in the skeletal muscle, and it basically prevents people with cerebral palsy from fully regenerating their muscles after the muscle has been damaged from growth or exercise or mechanical stimulation.
You're approaching this from a bioengineering perspective or school of thought. And how does bioengineering relate to the body? Does this come back to the mathematical modeling?
Yeah, well, I mean, bioengineering as a field, there's a few sort of different branches of it, but most of my colleagues at the Bioengineering Institute use traditional engineering approaches, traditional engineering techniques to study physiology and to understand disease and health, biology, physiology, and biomedical applications. And so the computational models that we're building are, they're sort of engineering style models. Some of the mechanical models that we use, for instance, they're called finite element models. So that's a framework that came from aerospace and civil engineering. And so, we went from using this technique to study the way that, say, fighter jets deform to using this technique to study the way tissues deform, like skeletal muscle and tendon and bone and cartilage. And so that's sort of that's the background that I'm bringing to studying cerebral palsy and trying to use models to understand how the tissue's deforming and how it's degenerating, et cetera.
What is the hope here for therapy? You alluded to it, but just help me here. It's my understanding that this is that CP is a condition caused by damage to parts of the brain, either before or during or perhaps soon after childbirth, and often there's a delay in diagnosis, right?
That's right, yeah.
And
Yeah.
if early diagnosis could happen, what are some of the possibilities for interventions, as you said, or for therapy? What are people hoping for?
Yeah, great question. So I have some colleagues who are working on that specific question. Some colleagues here in Auckland who are trying to use machine learning and cell phone cameras even to basically track the movements of very young kids and see if there's something that eludes the human eye that could indicate that a young kid has cerebral palsy. So yeah, typically kids will be 3 or 4 years old before their parent or their doctor notices that their movement is a little abnormal, and then with some diagnostics and some brain scans, they can see that parts of the brain are we call it a neural insult, so that there's basically part of the brain that's been damaged. Sometimes in utero or soon after birth. There's also genetic markers for cerebral palsy. So in many cases, actually, it's just a genetic factor that's contributed to this brain injury. So early diagnosis basically allows us to start, well, one, start doing some physiotherapy interventions really young. Before they have that abnormal of motion, we can start to improve the way that they're moving, improve the way that they're walking. In a lot of cases, the way that muscles and bones develop is a result of how a child is moving. And so we encourage young kids, pediatric age kids to, crawl at a certain age and start walking at a certain age and move around. And all of that is really, really good for the way that their bones and muscles develop. And so if a kid has cerebral palsy and is maybe pre-diagnosis and they're moving abnormally, there could be a lot of impacts to their muscles and bones and the way that they're developing in their joints. And if we can have an early intervention, early diagnosis, we can start to make sure that they're moving in a way for those bones and muscles and joints to develop as normally as possible. There are also potential interventions that we haven't really even discovered yet because, historically we haven't been diagnosing this really, really early. So when the muscles are still more typical, more normal, there might be things we can do to promote, keeping the muscle that way, and not allowing it to fail to grow or allowing it to degenerate, that kind of thing. So we're still kind of on the early, early days here for the research. And so a lot of the research that I do is trying to understand these dynamics, trying to understand what's going on in the muscles in cerebral palsy, how the muscle effects follow downstream from the neural impairment. And so in getting a lot of that insight, we think that there's a lot of hope for developing treatments and treating kids earlier than they have been.
And that is Jeffrey Hansfield talking about his work there with the Musculoskeletal Modelling Group at the Auckland Bioengineering Institute at the University of Auckland. But earlier we were talking about this practice of forest bathing, the Japanese practice that more and more people are adopting for its therapeutic benefits. Jeffrey is a certified forest guide here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland.